Dreamscape presents Empire of Sin by Gary Crist, narrated by Robert Sundin. It is no easy matter to go to heaven by way of New Orleans. Reverend J. Chandler Gregg. Prologue. The crime, as detectives would later tell the newspapers, was one of the most gruesome in the annals of the New Orleans police. At 5 a.m. on the sultry morning of May 23, 1918, the bodies of Joseph and Catherine Maggio, Italian immigrants who ran a small grocery store in a remote section of the city, were found sprawled across the disordered bedroom of the living quarters behind their store. Both had been savagely attacked, apparently while they slept. Joseph Maggio lay face up on the blood-sodden bed, his skull split by a deep, jagged gash several inches long. Catherine Maggio, her own skull nearly hewn in two, was stretched out on the floor beneath him. Each victim's throat had been slashed with a sharp instrument. A blood-smeared axe and shaving razor, obviously the murder weapons, had been found on the floor nearby. Police Superintendent Frank T. Mooney stood among the dozen or so detectives and patrolmen working over the grocery for clues. Summoned from his bed before dawn, the superintendent had immediately rushed out to the crime scene, located at the corner of Magnolia and Upper Line Streets. It was a godforsaken neighborhood on the outskirts of uptown New Orleans, a place where a few single-story pine-board shacks stood amid a sea of weed-choked empty lots. Until recent years, this area had been little more than a fetid swamp, populated by alligators and slender-necked herons. But now, people actually lived here, Italians mostly, along with an assortment of other recent immigrants, and a few blacks, too poor to live anywhere else. Like much of the part of New Orleans set far back from the river and its natural levee, it was an inadequate place for human habitation, a breeding ground for all kinds of disease and squalor. And now, it had become a breeding ground for crime as well. Street lighting was still unheard of out here, and even the slightest rain could transform the low-lying, unpaved streets into stagnant rivers of muck, impossible for even the sturdiest of police vehicles to navigate. Frank Mooney, 48 years old and still new to his job, understood that he had to oversee the investigation of this case very closely. It would be the first high-profile homicide of his tenure as police superintendent, and a crime so strange and sensational was bound to attract all kinds of unwanted publicity. In some ways, the case seemed straightforward enough. The intruder had clearly taken the Maggio's own axe from the backyard shed and used it to chisel out a panel of the kitchen door and pry off the lock. He had then entered the kitchen, carried the axe down the short hallway to the bedroom, and used it, and perhaps the shaving razor, to butcher the sleeping Maggios. He'd apparently made no attempt to hide the murder weapons or otherwise obscure any evidence of the brutal crime that had occurred in that tiny, airless bedroom. The question of motive, though, was more problematic. Robbery seemed the most obvious explanation, but there was little proof that anything had actually been taken from the house. True, the grocer's bedside safe had been found open and empty, but there were no signs that the safe had been forced, and right beneath it sat a tin box, wrapped in a woman's stocking, containing several hundred dollars worth of jewelry. Mooney's officers also found $100 in cash secreted under Joseph Maggio's pillow. No professional thief could have overlooked such easy booty. Chief of Detectives George Long, the experienced investigator whom Mooney had put in charge of the case, had a different theory, one that implicated Andrew Maggio, Joseph's younger brother, who lived in the other half of the grocery building on Magnolia Street. Andrew had been the first person to discover the bodies, after allegedly hearing a scuffle in his brother's apartment and going next door to investigate. He was a barber by profession, and several days earlier had been seen taking a straight razor from his shop to have a nick honed from the blade. Based on this evidence alone, Andrew Maggio, along with another younger Maggio brother, had been detained for questioning. But there was one incongruous piece of evidence that seemed to exonerate the brothers and to point to another kind of perpetrator entirely. Shortly before noon, two detectives canvassing the neighborhood had stumbled across a clue just a block away from the murder scene. Right at the corner of Robertson and Upper Line, scrawled across the planks of a wooden banquet, as sidewalks are called in New Orleans, they'd found a chalk message written in a crude, childish hand. Mrs. Joseph Maggio is going to sit up tonight, just like Mrs. Tony. It was baffling. Why would Andrew Maggio, or anyone else in his right mind, leave behind such a gratuitous clue to the murders? A couple of Mooney's more senior detectives raised an unsettling possibility. They told the superintendent about a series of unsolved attacks on Italian grocers that had occurred in the city some years ago. At least three of those attacks had been committed with a hatchet. One victim, who, like Maggio, had been slain in bed with his wife, was named Tony Sciambra. Could Mrs. Sciambra be the Mrs. Tony in the chalk scrawl? And if so, what did it mean? At the time of the earlier attacks, police had attributed the crimes to the local Black Hand, a loosely knit organization of Italian extortionists that New Orleanians commonly, though not accurately, called the Mafia. But the Black Hand had supposedly been eliminated in the city some time ago. The New Orleans police had waged a long and bitter fight against the shadowy organization to root out its members and end what had been a virtual epidemic of blackmail and murder in the city's Italian community. By 1918, it was widely believed that the battle had been won. But now, Frank Mooney had his own pair of murdered Italian grocers to deal with, and it was certain that everyone in New Orleans would be watching to see how their rookie superintendent handled the case. 10 months earlier, when he was first named to the position, the Times-Picayune had questioned the wisdom of Mooney's selection. Was it a good idea, the paper had asked, to trust command of the entire police department to a former railroad executive whose law enforcement experience amounted to little more than a short stint as a rail yard cop many years ago? The new superintendent was clearly a police outsider, appointed by a mayor well known for bestowing city jobs on his political allies. Mooney didn't even look like a cop. With his gold-rimmed spectacles, brushy mustache, and stout, well-banqueted physique, he looked more like an insurance executive on his way to an industry convention in Omaha. And even though the Times-Picayune had praised Mooney's sterling qualities as a manager, the paper pointed out that these credentials did not guarantee success as commander of the New Orleans police. As police superintendent, he will be judged not by his past record, however creditable, but by the record he has yet to make. For Mooney, then, there was strong incentive to see Andrew Maggio as the perpetrator of these two murders and to write them off as isolated revenge killings or a domestic crime of passion, the kind of easily explicable incident that was all too common in New Orleans' poorer neighborhoods. Far better this explanation than attributing the attack to a return of Black Hand terrorism long after the police had supposedly eliminated that threat. The campaign against the Italian underworld, part of a larger effort by the so-called respectable white establishment to wrest control of their city from the forces of vice, crime, and corruption, had roiled New Orleans for the better part of 3 decades, eventually degenerating into something like all-out class warfare. A generation-long ordeal of lynchings, riots, and large-scale police raids had taken a harsh toll on the entire city. So for an untested police superintendent trying to convince his constituents that New Orleans' bad old days were indeed over, a resurrection of the Dago evil, as it was called, would be an ominous development indeed. But not perhaps the worst possible development. That would come a few months later. For by the end of that summer of 1918, with 3 more similar axe murders terrorizing the city, and the Times-Picayune openly speculating about a crazed serial killer on the loose, it would be clear that a very different kind of evil was at large in the squalid back streets of New Orleans. Part 1. The War Begins, 1890 to 1891. Chapter 1. Going Respectable. Shortly after 11 o'clock on a bright November morning, a handsome middle-aged man dashed up to the front door of the brothel at 172 Custom House Street in the French Quarter and let himself in with a key. It was still early for any kind of business at a New Orleans house of prostitution, so no one except the servants was up and about. But the man, Philip Lobrano, didn't have to be formally shown in. He was well known in the house. The front ground-floor bedroom was where he regularly consorted with the madam of the place, a woman who called herself Josie Lobrano. The two had been lovers and business partners for almost a decade, ever since Josie was 16 and the much older Lobrano had offered her his protection. And while she was technically and legally still Miss Mary Dubler, she used Philip's surname for professional purposes, though few people were apparently deceived. This was, after all, New Orleans in 1890, the crescent city of the Gilded Age, where aliases of convenience and unconventional living arrangements were anything but out of the ordinary, at least in certain parts of town. Identities were fluid here, and names and appearances weren't always the best guide to telling who was who. Dressed in knee-length frock coats, pinstriped trousers, and suavely cocked felt derbies, men who may or may not have been gentlemen strolled the gaslit avenues with fashionable young women who may or may not have been their wives. Clerks in the department stores on busy Canal Street were careful to ask their female customers that all-important question, "And where do we send the bill, madam?" in a hushed, confidential, knowing tone of voice. Newsboys of uncertain parentage hawked papers on street corners, and one could only wonder who was bankrolling the rakish ne'er-do-wells dropping hundreds at the fairgrounds racetrack, or in one of the backroom gambling dens in saloons all around town. And so, Philip Lobrano, aging but dapper, well-dressed but not conspicuously employed, entered the brothel of the woman known by some as his wife. He found Josie still in bed, sleeping late after the strain of a busy Friday night. Clearly in a state of some agitation, Lobrano told her to get up immediately and get dressed. He said that he had just seen one of her brothers, Peter Dubler, who worked sporadically as a streetcar motorman, in a bar on Royal Street, supremely drunk and apparently hungry for trouble. Peter was on his way over to the brothel, and when he arrived, Josie was to send the maid to the door to say they weren't home. If she let Peter in, Lobrano warned, she would have to take responsibility for the consequences. As Josie dressed, Lobrano recounted what had happened on Royal Street. He had been sitting in Louis George's saloon, quietly reading the newspaper, when an obviously intoxicated Peter Dubler wandered in. Seeing Lobrano, the young man ordered a bottle from the bartender and carried it over to his table. Philip wasn't particularly welcoming. He'd always disliked Josie's family, whom he considered little more than a flock of vultures, forever borrowing money and monopolizing too much of her time and attention. Even so, he tried at first to be civil. But Peter was still reeling from an all-night spree and was in a foul, abusive mood. In sarcastic tones, he invited Lobrano to have a drink with him, and when Lobrano declined, Peter became angry. "You bastard, come take a drink," he insisted, filling a glass and shoving it across the table. The bartender tried to intervene. "It looks as if you want to raise hell," he observed warily. Peter, a large, muscular man who had once single-handedly knocked down 6 men in a street fight, agreed that this was indeed his intention. Then, for reasons that would remain obscure, he began to deride Lobrano in a loud, menacing voice. Intimidated, Lobrano quickly finished his drink and got up to leave.
"I know where to find you,"
Peter said ominously as Lobrano turned away. A few minutes later, as Lobrano was hurrying over to Josie's, a friend who had been in the bar caught up with them on Canal Street. Peter, the friend warned, had begun to make threats against Lobrano just after the two had parted.
"I am going to kill that bastard Lobrano," Peter had said explicitly, in front of several witnesses, before stumbling out of the saloon.
Lobrano had barely finished telling this story to Josie when the brothel's front doorbell rang. That was Peter now, Lobrano warned, and he urged her not to let him in. But Josie seemed unconcerned. 26 years old, sturdily built like her brother, with attractive, somewhat hardened features accentuated by striking black eyebrows, she was hardly the timid, fearful type. Driven into prostitution as an 11-year-old orphan, Josie had been forced to fend for herself and her 2 younger brothers from the beginning. Years of struggling to survive on the streets of New Orleans had turned her into a tough and often combative woman. She had, in fact, been arrested for disorderly conduct several times, once for horsewhipping a young man on Palmyra Street, and again for brawling with a fellow prostitute named Beulah Ripley, who allegedly staggered from the scene of combat, missing part of her lower lip and half an ear. So Josie was not one to shy away from a confrontation, especially not with a member of her own family. Calling the maid, Josie instructed her to answer the door and see her brother in.
She would talk to him alone in the parlor and see what was the matter. Peter, however, turned out to be too drunk to take to the parlor. Apparently worried that he might make a scene and upset the other occupants of the house, Josie decided instead to bring him back to her bedroom.
"Are you here?"
Peter sneered when he saw his sister's paramour in the room. Lebrano asked him what he wanted, but Peter informed him that it was none of his business. Lebrano then insisted that Peter leave immediately, and when the intoxicated young man claimed he had a right to enter his sister's bedroom whenever he wished, Josie actually took her brother's side. She pointed out that the house belonged to her, and that Lebrano had no right to order anyone out of it. What happened next would be a matter of dispute for years to come. According to Philip Lebrano, after a few more angry words, he decided he'd had enough. He was just stepping to the door to leave when Peter suddenly lunged at him, punched him on the side of the face, and then made a gesture as if to pull a gun. According to Josie Lebrano, however, there was no lunge, no punch, and no threatening gesture. But the Lebranos did agree about Philip's next move. Spitting out a vile epithet, he reached into his coat for his own .32 caliber revolver, pointed it at Peter Dubler, and pulled the trigger. His aim was perhaps truer than he expected. The bullet struck Josie's brother squarely in the nose, tore through the base of his brain, and lodged in the back wall of his skull. Peter collapsed onto the bedroom floor, his face awash in blood. Josie screamed and fell to her knees beside her brother's fallen body. Amazingly, Peter still seemed to be conscious.
"You've done it, Phil,"
he allegedly cried through his shattered face. But Lebrano, standing amid the coiling smoke from the barrel of his pistol, didn't linger to see what it was he'd done. Pushing past the maid, who now stood horrified just outside the doorway, he ran out of the bedroom, hurried down the hallway, and exited by a side door into an alley off Burgundy Street. Drawn by the sound of gunfire, a crowd soon gathered on Custom House Street outside. The Lebrano's neighbors in the French Quarter, or the Vucare, as it was more commonly called, had been expecting trouble at the brothel for some time. Philip and Josie had never lived peaceably together, and their domestic quarrels had brought police to the door more than once over the years. But in recent weeks, the discord between the two had become even fiercer than usual. As several members of the crowd later told a reporter, they'd all expected a tragedy to take place at almost any time in that house. Within minutes, Corporal Thomas Duffy of the New Orleans Police arrived on the scene and shoved his way through the crowd. He entered the brothel and found Josie standing over her brother's blood-drenched form, surrounded by a half dozen of her prostitutes in various states of undress. Duffy quickly summoned an ambulance and then tried to question the witnesses about the incident. But he didn't get very far. Josie, tough as she was apparently too upset to make much sense, and the other women professed to know nothing about the shooting. At the time it occurred, they claimed, they'd all been upstairs in their bedrooms waiting for breakfast to be served. Convinced that they were not telling everything they knew, Duffy threatened to take the whole lot of them down to the station in a paddy wagon. This caused something of an uproar among the women. They had done nothing wrong, they argued, and certainly didn't deserve to be carted away like common criminals. Some said they wouldn't go unless they could walk to the station, others insisted on traveling in cabs. But Duffy's patience had by now been exhausted. When the horse-drawn paddy wagon arrived, he and several other policemen herded the quarrelsome young women into the vehicle. Then he rode with them through the roiling streets of the Vucare to the 3rd Precinct Station, where they were questioned and, amid much complaint about the cruel treatment they had received, released. In the meantime, Philip Lebrano had apparently thought better of leaving the scene of the shooting. Shortly after noon, he walked into the Central Police Station on Basin Street and surrendered himself to the officer in charge, Captain John Journey. The latest word from the Hotel Dieu Hospital was that Peter Dubler's wound was very dangerous, perhaps even fatal. So Journey immediately took Lebrano into custody. He threw the prisoner into one of the station's holding cells, where he sat for a few hours before being transferred to the second recorder's court. There, he was arraigned on a charge of shooting with intent to murder. Pleading not guilty, he was remanded to the Orleans Parish Prison in the Treme District to be held without bail. Peter Dubler underwent surgery that afternoon and was moved to one of the Hotel Dieu's recovery wards, where doctors refused to allow anyone, even Josie, to see him. His condition stabilized and then improved over the next few days. At one point, he even seemed well enough to be sent home. But his recovery was short-lived. Within a week, he was back at the Hotel Dieu, sinking rapidly with a raging fever. He died there on December 9th at 2:15 in the afternoon, 10 days after being shot. The incident at Josie Lebrano's brothel became the talk of the Bucarest for some time thereafter. Murder, of course, was no novelty in the city's vice districts in 1890, but the Lebranos were well-known characters in that world, and so the shooting took on all the allure of celebrity scandal among the city's demi-mondaines. However, like many crimes in 19th-century New Orleans, it ultimately had few dire consequences for the perpetrator. Philip Lebrano went on to be tried twice for the murder of Peter Dubler. Both times, the defense successfully convinced a majority of jurors that the shooting had been committed in self-defense. The initial trial, after many delays and false starts, ended in a hung jury. The second, however, brought an actual acquittal, and on March 31, 1892, Lebrano was released from prison after 14 months of incarceration. But Lebrano's easy life as the kept man of a successful New Orleans madam was over. Long before his release, Josie Lebrano, devastated by her brother's death and determined to be rid of her longtime paramour, had abruptly cut all business and romantic ties to him. At the same time, she also resolved to change a few other aspects of her life. For the previous 15 years, as a prostitute and madam, Josie had been living a violent, dissolute existence among society's most debauched elements. But the pointless killing of her brother had altered something in her. She'd apparently done some soul-searching and now claimed that she was ready to turn over a new leaf. Josie wouldn't close the brothel, of course. The business was too lucrative, and sex work was the only thing she knew. But she was determined to change the way she lived, to end her old low-life associations, get rid of her current roster of fractious girls, and cater to a new and better class of customer. She would also find herself a more agreeable inamorato, and perhaps even a wealthy patron to partner with. It might take some time, and more than a little money, but Josie Lebrano, until now known as one of the rudest and toughest madams in the Vieux-Carré, had decided to become respectable. Chapter 2. The Sodom of the South. Respectability. Josie Lebrano was not alone in her pursuit of it in Gilded Age New Orleans. The concept of respectability was very much in the air in the city of the 1880s and 90s, championed in newspaper editorials, debated in clubs and parlors, and trumpeted from church pulpits all over town. This was, after all, the era of high Victorianism, and even a place like the Crescent City was not impervious to the stringent ideals of the day. Granted, respectability might have meant one thing to a French Quarter madam, involving not much more than an enthusiastic embrace of the trappings of wealth, exclusivity, and a certain faux high-class refinement. But for members of what was optimistically called polite society, the standards were somewhat higher. Keeping brawls and gunfire out of one's home was the least of it. In 19th-century New Orleans, however, respectability was arguably more difficult to achieve and maintain than in almost any other place on the continent. Threats to decency were everywhere, and the city's lax cosmopolitan ethos hardly conformed to mainstream American norms of behavior. Thanks to its unique history, in fact, New Orleans scarcely seemed American at all. Founded as a French outpost in the early 1700s, the city had come of age under Spanish rule in the latter half of the 18th century, giving the place a distinctive Franco-Latin character that still manifested itself in everything from its architecture to its municipal administration. And although the 1803 Louisiana Purchase had forcibly thrust the city into the rapidly growing United States, several decades as capital of the American South had done only so much to make it seem less foreign. "I doubt if there is a city in the world," Frederick Law Olmsted said of New Orleans in 1856, "where the resident population has been so divided in its origin, or where there is such a variety in the tastes, habits, manners, and moral codes of the citizens." And this extraordinary multiplicity, augmented by successive waves of immigration from Europe and the Caribbean, had only grown more pronounced as the century progressed. "What a mingling of peoples," another visitor marveled in 1880. "Americans and Brazilians, West Indians, Spanish and French, Germans, Creoles, Quadroons, Mulattoes, Chinese, and Negroes." The urban culture that developed around this confluence of races and ethnicities was something that the rest of the country soon came to regard with a combination of wonder, suspicion, and often abhorrence. Worldly New Orleans was emphatically unlike, say, Lutheran Minneapolis, or even the Baptist cities in the rest of the South. For one thing, New Orleans wasn't even Protestant, at least not much beyond the handful of uptown neighborhoods containing the enclaves of Anglo-American privilege. It was still a largely Latin, Catholic city, with entrenched attitudes and mores that could seem, to anyone aspiring to conservative Protestant standards of rectitude, distressingly exotic. As such, it was a strange and disturbing place to many, a place where married white men attended quadroon balls to find mixed-race concubines, where macabre voodoo rituals occurred in shanties and back alleys, and where even prominent politicians might meet in City Park to duel with pistols or épées at dawn. In the city's notorious Tenderloin districts, brothels specialized in all manner of interracial mixing and arcane sexual practices, while narcotics, alcohol, and loud, degenerate kinds of music filled the saloons and dance halls, promoting deviant behavior of all kinds. The Crescent City was also a place cursed with a deep-rooted culture of violence and crime. Colorful miscreants stalked the streets, warring vice lords shot up their rivals' saloons and gambling dens, and mysterious Italians, purportedly members of the murky organization called the Mafia or the Black Hand, assassinated one another for obscure and sinister reasons. For visitors from other parts of the country, and for the city's growing ranks of white Protestant elites, the opportunities for moral contamination were legion. As one Victorian minister put it in 1868, "It is no easy matter to go to heaven by way of New Orleans." Even so, it wasn't until the last decades of the 19th century that respectability had become such a burning preoccupation among the better element in New Orleans, or crime and indecency the source of such widespread outrage. True, gambling, prostitution, street violence, and bawdy entertainment had been a prominent feature of the city's life for its entire history, but up till this point they had been confined to certain well-defined zones along the waterfront and in several lower-class neighborhoods, places that could easily be avoided in the course of the average upstanding citizen's day. Ensconced in the Garden District around St. Charles Avenue, decent men, and especially women, could insulate themselves from the goings-on back of town, or in the mixed neighborhoods downriver from Canal Street. But in the decades after Reconstruction, these goings-on had begun to spread from the traditional vice areas into reputable residential and commercial districts all over town, endangering the morals of anyone who rode a streetcar, dined at a restaurant, or shopped in one of the city's markets or department stores. The assaults on respectability, in fact, had become all but ubiquitous in New Orleans. The rise of concert saloons, raucous theaters where patrons could drink while watching erotically suggestive stage performances, had brought crime and high-profile immorality to some of the busiest shopping avenues in the city. Establishments offering so-called coon music, considered a dangerous inducement to lewd dancing and cross-racial fraternization, were also making inroads. Once confined to the black clubs and dance halls of poorer neighborhoods, the music could now assail the ears of bankers and merchants on Canal Street itself, the main artery of the business district. And perhaps most scandalous of all, brothels and assignation houses had become impossible to avoid, cropping up in many places where decent middle-class families lived. Many felt that a man could no longer feel comfortable in his own home, never knowing when the house next door might be sold and turned into a disorderly house, forcing his wife and children to bear witness to scenes of the utmost wickedness and depravity. "The social evil is rampant in our midst," wrote The Mascot, the city's major crusading weekly, in 1892. "Houses of assignation and ill fame are springing up all over the city. Many a man has purchased a house and lot on a quiet street, but has woke up some morning to find the house next door occupied by disreputable people who carouse, receive visitors, hammer the piano all night, use obscene language, and convert his paradise into a hell." The effects of this expansion of vice and crime were now plain to see throughout the city. Stories abounded of honest, job-seeking women being ruined by unscrupulous concert saloon proprietors, of agents steering underage girls to bordello keepers for a commission, and of dressmakers' assistants and messenger boys being seduced into the sporting life while making deliveries to brothels, saloons, and gambling houses. By the late 1880s, criminality of all types in the city seemed virtually out of control. At no time since the war has crime been so rampant or criminals so free as at present, observed the mascot in 1888. Within the past 2 months, several brutal and deliberate murders have been planned and perpetrated. Young girls have been outraged. Homes have been burglarized. Citizens have been maltreated by officers of the law. Poor little newborn babes have been pitilessly slaughtered, and any number of men have taken their own lives for real or fancied causes. But as yet, there has been no stop to the era of blood and degradation. Blacks and immigrants, especially Italians, were of course scapegoated for much of the lawlessness and moral corruption. Complaints about the debased behavior at Negro dives were a frequent feature of local newspaper coverage, which became especially virulent when that behavior crossed the color line. Meanwhile, the violence and crime endemic to the city's Little Palermo, the ramshackle downriver end of the Vucare, was the cause of even greater editorial spleen in the press. "If given our choice between the Negro and the Dago," one writer fulminated in 1889, "we are inclined to believe that we would take the woolly son of Africa in preference to the greasy, filthy son of Italy. The Dagos are a curse to New Orleans." The fact that both groups were considered a disruptive element in local politics only deepened the antagonism of the city's native-born Anglo-American elite. Black votes were widely regarded as for sale to the highest bidder, while Italians and other immigrants provided a reliable base of support for the Ring, the powerful and corrupt democratic machine that had controlled city government for much of its recent history. For so-called respectable New Orleans, then, the situation had become dire indeed. The lawlessness, municipal dysfunction, flagrant sexuality, and increasing visibility of vice posed a threat not just to individual reputations, but also to the reputation of the city as a whole. And all of this was happening at a time when New Orleans desperately needed to project an image of competence and stability to the world. The city's antebellum glory days, when booming business in sugar, cotton, and slaves made it the queen city of the South, indispensable to world trade, were long past. Decades of civil war and federal occupation had been hard on the local economy, while competition from newer railroad centers and other faster-growing ports had eaten away at the city's commercial supremacy. Formerly the fourth-largest city in the country, New Orleans had since dropped to ninth place. And while business was still growing in absolute numbers, the city government had taken on a level of debt that severely limited its ability to remain competitive. The result was a city that had become hopelessly backward, at least in terms of urban development. Other major cities, New York, Chicago, St. Louis, had surged ahead with electrified streetcars, modern sanitation facilities, and miles of well-paved streets. But New Orleans seemed stuck in an earlier era. Streetcars were still pulled by dusty, overworked mules. Sewage ran through open gutters at the edges of dirt-paved or otherwise primitive streets. Few residents had running water, and the city's main arteries, except for the recently electrified main drag of Canal Street, were still illuminated by old-fashioned gas lamps. New Orleans, it was often observed, was the first American metropolis to build an opera house, but the last to build a sewerage system. By the late 1800s, then, the city desperately needed to rebuild its port and overhaul its increasingly antiquated infrastructure. To do all of that, it urgently needed to attract northern capital investment. But, as one local businessman wrote, "the reputation of our city has been fearful, and it has been utterly impossible to interest capital in any enterprise in New Orleans." Faced with this rapidly deteriorating situation, the Crescent City's self-anointed leading citizens had by 1888 concluded that drastic measures were necessary to halt the city's moral and economic slide. In that year, a well-heeled young lawyer named William S. Parkerson formed a new political party, the Young Men's Democratic Association, with the explicit purpose of taking on the Ring machine that had allowed such conditions to flourish in the city. Other similar parties, of course, had risen up with the same goal in the past, only to falter after a few years of limited electoral success. But Parkerson's YMDA had some very powerful supporters. Its campaign committee, as one historian put it, read like a blue book of the city's commercial elite, and they were all determined to put the city on the road to long-desired reform. Rejecting the candidates put up by Democratic Party regulars in the Spring City elections, a ticket which is an insult to the intelligence of this community and a menace to its progress and integrity, the YMDA instead rallied around its own slate of higher-toned hopefuls. Led by mayoral candidate Joseph A. Shakespeare, the YMDA ticket promised the voters a war on vice and corruption, a total revamping of the city's inept and venal police department, and a large-scale effort to revitalize the crumbling infrastructure through honest tax collection and other sound business practices. And the reformers backed these heady promises with a threat that their opponents could understand. The association was gathering an arsenal and would ensure that the election was conducted properly, if need be, at the point of the bayonet. The strong-arm tactics worked. Though ring operatives attempted countless questionable devices and election legermain to steal the vote, armed contingents of YMDA men at every polling station kept the usual hired thugs and vote buyers in check. And when the votes were counted, Shakespeare had won a commanding victory, with the rest of the reform slate taking all but two of the city's 17 wards. The triumphant Parkerson, offered the position of city attorney in Shakespeare's new administration, ultimately declined to serve. But he, along with his gun-toting private militia, would remain a potent force backing the new mayor in all of his endeavors to come. For the cream of New Orleans society, this was a hopeful beginning. At least for the time being, the so-called better half, the city's clergymen and newspaper editors, its upright lawyers and businessmen, its social reformers and club women, would control city government with a popular mandate for change that few could gainsay. But the job before them was clear. In order to survive and thrive in the coming new century, the city of New Orleans, like brothel Madame Josie Lebrano, was going to have to remake itself along more respectable lines. The city would have to normalize its scandalous sex life, isolate and regulate its notorious entertainment districts, and take control of the infamous crime on its streets. The task would be formidable, requiring direct confrontation with the forces of the city's demimonde, its entrenched vice industries, and its black and immigrant underworlds. To win their city back, in other words, the self-styled champions of respectability and order were going to have to launch the equivalent of an all-out civil war. That the first major casualty in this war was the city's popular police chief, David Hennessy, gunned down in front of his own home, was an early indication of just how bitterly the conflict was going to be fought. Chapter 3. The First Casualty. The war began quietly enough on a chilly, wet evening in October of 1890. At the weekly police board meeting at City Hall, New Orleans Mayor Joseph A. Shakespeare was presiding over the disciplinary hearing of two police officers accused of blackmail. Beside him at the examiner's table sat the other four members of the police board, along with several clerks and Superintendent and Chief of Police David C. Hennessy. Rain pattered the tall windows of the boardroom as the last of the early evening light faded away. Sergeant James Lynch and Stableman H. Thibodeau, both officers from the 8th Precinct, just across the river in Algiers, stood in front of the board, listening to the charges against them. The pair had been accused of extorting bribes from several grocery saloons on a Sunday evening 10 days earlier. The officers had allegedly gone from one establishment to another in Algiers, demanding drinks. Then, when they were served, they would turn around and threaten to charge the owners with a violation of the city's putatively faith-based Sunday closing law unless they paid an adequate bribe. Four of their victims had felt outraged enough to file complaints with the police department. Sergeant Lynch, asked to respond to the charges, pled not guilty and requested that the hearing be postponed to allow him and Thibodeau to prepare a defense. But Shakespeare wouldn't hear of it. The mayor pointed out that the witnesses had been put to substantial trouble coming over on the ferry from Algiers on such a rainy evening. The board would therefore hear their testimony that night. The accused could answer the charges at a later date. Shakespeare, now more than 2 years into his term, was doubtless feeling somewhat outraged himself. The law forbidding Sunday liquor sales was one of his own pet initiatives, and to see it abused by the city's own police must have been particularly galling. Reforming the police department, after all, had been one of the major planks in the platform on which he'd been elected back in 1888. Virtually his first act as mayor had been to appoint his friend Hennessy as chief, instructing him to reorganize the entire department and get rid of the corrupt elements that had plagued it for decades. The accusations against Lynch and Thibodeau, unfortunately, showed just how much remained to be done. Not that anyone was blaming the chief of police for the lingering problems. David C. Hennessy, tall, lean, and dourly handsome, sporting the ubiquitous shapely mustache of 1890s fashion, was one of the most popular and admired figures in the Crescent City. Hired as a police messenger while still a boy, after his father, a longtime Metro policeman, was killed in a barroom gunfight, he'd been a lawman all his life. His selection as the country's youngest police chief had been widely applauded at the time, particularly by the reform-minded element that had swept Shakespeare and his allies into office. True, Hennessy had detractors. As a young man, he had once shot and killed a rival detective on the street, and there were some who still claimed that the shooting was unprovoked. But the incident had ultimately been ruled a killing in self-defense, and all charges against Hennessy had subsequently been dropped. Now, at 32 years of age, he was regarded by many as the straightest of straight arrows. According to the local papers, Hennessy didn't drink, he didn't gamble, and he even avoided fraternizing with women, except for his widowed mother, with whom he lived in a modest cottage on Gerard Street. He was also a deeply religious man, stopping at the Jesuit church every evening at 6 to pray. He was seen by most reformers, in short, as a man of unimpeachable honesty and character, just the person they needed to reinvigorate the police department and start cleaning up the vice and crime-ridden place their city had become. But as the testimony of the four witnesses was making painfully obvious, progress had been slow. One of the alleged victims, an Italian grocer named Philip Garacci, described the two officers entering his shop at 7 p.m. and demanding cash from the till. Apparently, this was not the first confrontation between them. "You had threatened me before," Garacci said, addressing Officer Thibodeau. "You had cursed me and called me a dirty dago. Everybody knows you are a bulldozer and a tough, and I was never in trouble until you forced me into it." Shakespeare clearly found this story plausible enough, and when the other witness's testimony proved just as damning, the mayor decided that he'd heard all he needed to hear. He, Hennessy, and the rest of the board agreed that the evidence of extortion was irrefutable. And so, with the self-righteous peremptoriness that was to characterize the reformers' efforts for decades to come, they decided to dismiss the two officers on the spot, without waiting to hear their defense. Why bother with the niceties of judicial process, after all, when there was an entire city to clean up? After the police board meeting adjourned, the chief and another officer, Captain William Billy O'Connor of the Boylan Private Detective Agency, sat in Hennessy's office at the Central Police Station, chatting idly for an hour before heading home for the night. O'Connor was the chief's old friend, a former colleague who could often be found in Hennessy's company around town. But tonight, he was accompanying his friend on a semi-official basis. O'Connor was acting as the chief's bodyguard for the evening. After several anonymous threats to Hennessy's life over the past few months, the city had arranged with the Boylan Agency to provide the chief with round-the-clock protection. And though Hennessy himself regarded this precaution as unnecessary, Mayor Shakespeare had insisted upon it. The fact that the job had gone to the private Boylan Agency indicated how much confidence the mayor put in his own police department. The death threats had stemmed from an ongoing investigation that the chief was conducting into the city's Italian underworld. For some time now, New Orleans' Italian community had been roiled by a struggle between two rival families for the lucrative dockworker contracts on the city's downriver wharves. The Provenzanos, who originally had the contracts with the city's fruit importers, and the Matrangas, who eventually wrested them away, forcing the Provenzanos out of business, had been feuding violently. The resulting wave of back-alley shootings and stabbings had outraged the city's business community, who cited it as just the kind of nonsense that was scaring away investment from northern capitalists. After several violent murders of alleged Provenzano and Matranga associates in late 1888 and early 1889, Hennessy had decided to take action. Inviting representatives of both clans to the Red Light Club on Custom House Street, he all but forced them to shake hands in truce, warning them that the city would no longer tolerate their feuds. The perpetrator of any crime in the Italian community, Hennessy warned, would henceforth be hunted down and prosecuted to the full extent of the law. But the truce ended up lasting for less than a year. On the night of May 5, 1890, the Matranga brothers and five of their workers were returning home after a long day's work on the docks when their horse-drawn wagon was ambushed by gunmen on Esplanade Avenue. Several men were injured, including family patriarch Antonio Matranga himself, who eventually lost a leg as a result of his injuries. Six Provenzano men were accused of the attack and subsequently tried, and although the six were convicted, Chief Hennessy was dissatisfied with the verdict. Convinced that the shooting victims had perjured themselves at the trial, he launched an investigation into the Matranga organization, even sending to Italy for information that might tie the family to alleged mafia crime figures in Sicily. Exactly what Hennessy had turned up in his research was never made public, but it was apparently damning enough to convince a judge to vacate the Provenzano convictions and order a new trial, and to mark the chief himself, scheduled to testify in the retrial, as a rumored target for assassination. But on this rainy Wednesday night in October, just 2 days before the scheduled start of the Provenzano retrial, Hennessy seemed anything but worried about his safety. The chief was in the best of spirits, O'Connor would later recall to reporters, and as the two men left the police station at a few minutes after 11, the chief was even feeling sociable enough to invite his bodyguard into Dominic Virgit's saloon to share a dozen oysters, which Hennessy, the famous teetotaler, washed down with a small glass of milk. The driving rain had all but stopped by the time they left Virgit's. A drizzly mist now crept along the gleaming streets, muffling the men's footsteps as they walked up Rampart. At the corner of Girard, just a few blocks from the chief's house, they stopped. "Don't come any further with me now," Hennessy told his friend. "You go on and look after your business." O'Connor was reluctant at first, but he knew that several other Boylan officers were stationed near the chief's house on Girard, watching over the neighborhood, and there were still many other people abroad in the streets, despite the late hour and rainy weather. So O'Connor decided that his friend would be safe enough. The two men bade each other goodnight and headed off in opposite directions into the gloom. Chief Hennessy began walking the remaining 2 blocks to his house. This part of Girard Street was hardly a fashionable neighborhood in 1890, its motley collection of cottages, rooming houses, and cobbler shops inhabited by a variety of working-class blacks and immigrants. But old Mrs. Hennessy had lived there for many years and was reluctant to move, and so the chief, deeply devoted as he was to his mother, still lived there too, though he could certainly have afforded a home in the more prosperous neighborhoods farther uptown. Besides, the house was just a few minutes by foot from his office at the Central Police Station, always an advantage when a late-night emergency cropped up. Shortly before the chief reached the end of the first block, a young boy emerged from a doorway ahead of him. The boy began whistling a tune, then raced ahead and turned the corner onto Basin Street. The chief apparently thought nothing suspicious in this, and he continued up Girard Street without pause. But after a few more steps, just as he was passing the shut-up second-hand store at number 269, a volley of gunshots erupted from an alley directly across the street. Before the chief could react, shotgun pellets tore through his umbrella and overcoat, searing his chest, wrist, and legs. Knocked sideways into the wall of the building, he instinctively reached for his pearl-handled Colt revolver and managed to get off a few wild rounds. But his bullets apparently missed their mark. Pistols began firing from another location on the street. Then, according to several witnesses roused by the initial burst of gunfire, 2 or 3 men with sawed-off shotguns emerged from the alley, firing again as they stepped into the street. The chief was hit repeatedly as he fell to the sidewalk, blood soaking his vest and white-checked trousers. Finally, with a shout, the gunmen were gone, scattering in several directions through the puddle-streaked streets. William O'Connor, after parting from the chief, had not even reached the next intersection when he heard the initial gunfire. He turned in time to see the flash of more shots coming from a small, 2-story frame house a block and a half away, then heard the 4 shots from Hennessy's revolver. He immediately started running back up Girard Street. On the way, he encountered Officer M. Cotter, one of the Boylan men assigned to patrol the neighborhood.
"Which way did they run?" O'Connor asked.
"I believe it was uptown." O'Connor sent the man in pursuit of the gunman. Then he continued running up Girard in search of Hennessy. The chief seemed to have disappeared, but when O'Connor had nearly reached Basin Street, he heard a call coming from around the corner.
"Oh, Billy. Billy."
O'Connor turned the corner and saw his friend slumped in a doorway down the street.
"They have given it to me,"
the chief said, as O'Connor rushed up to him.
I gave them back the best I could.
Hennessy was bleeding profusely from his face, arms, and legs. His bloodied overcoat was shredded up and down the left side. The spent revolver hung from his right hand.
Who gave it to you, Dave?
O'Connor asked. Hennessy told him to come closer, and then, as O'Connor bent over him, the chief allegedly uttered a single word.
Dagos.
By now, numerous neighbors and uniformed police were on the street, gathering around the chief's hunched form in the doorway. Several men helped carry the wounded Hennessy into the house, the Gillis residence at 189 Basin, while O'Connor ran to a grocery store across the street to telephone for an ambulance and notify the central police station. When he returned, he found Hennessy propped up on pillows on the floor of the Gillis' parlor, being tended by Auguste Gillis and her mother. They untied the chief's cravat and loosened his bloody collar and cuffs. Hennessy was obviously in great pain, but said very little. When one of the women offered to go get his mother, however, he roused himself to speak.
No, for God's sake, don't do that, he said. My poor mother.
Soon the horse-drawn ambulance arrived on Basin Street. The chief was wrapped in a heavy blanket and carried out to the waiting vehicle. The ambulance then rushed him to nearby Charity Hospital, with O'Connor following in a police patrol wagon. A half mile downriver on Basin Street, the central police station was in an uproar. Mayor Shakespeare, summoned from his home by news of the shooting, was meeting with police department officials to orchestrate the investigation. No one seemed to doubt who was responsible for the ambush. Scores of police were out in the streets, gathering evidence and searching for Italian suspects. Already one weapon, a double-barreled, muzzle-loading shotgun with a collapsible stock, allegedly a mafia weapon, had been found in a gutter on Franklin Street, dropped by one of the fleeing gunmen. But now day officers, roused from sleep, were at the station waiting to be deployed. George Vandervoort, Chief Hennessy's secretary, asked Mayor Shakespeare for instructions. The mayor was in no mood for subtlety.
Scour the whole neighborhood, he said. Arrest every Italian you come across, if necessary, and scour it again tomorrow morning as soon as there is light enough. Get all the men you need.
At Charity Hospital, Chief Hennessy was now lying on the table in the operating amphitheater, which by this time was filled with anxious friends, colleagues, and reporters. The chief's blood-stained shirt and undershirt had been cut away, and he was being examined by assistant house surgeon J.D. Bloom and several student physicians. What they found was not encouraging. Hennessy had received multiple bullet wounds, one in his right leg, another in his left forearm. But the most serious wounds were the four ugly, gaping holes that cratered the left side of his torso. One of these seemed especially dangerous. A bullet, after entering the chest just below the left nipple, had apparently grazed the pericardium, or heart sac, perforated the right lung, and lodged under the skin near the eighth rib. In Bloom's opinion, the wound was inoperable. And though it was not necessarily fatal, the surgeon thought it best, after bandaging all of the wounds, to call in a priest to administer last rites. Shortly after 1 o'clock, old Mrs. Hennessy was finally brought to the amphitheater, clinging to the arm of Thomas C. Anderson, one of her son's closest friends. Hennessy was still conscious and spoke in consoling tones to her, assuring her that she needn't worry about him.
Now go home, mother, he said after a few minutes with her. I am all right.
Reluctantly, the old woman let herself be led away. Assistant Recorder David Hollander then approached the wounded man.
Chief, you know who I am, he whispered. Do you wish to make a declaration?
The question was veiled but unambiguous. If the chief had recognized or could give a description of any of his assailants, now was the time to make a statement, a dying declaration that would be admissible evidence in court. But Hennessy stubbornly refused.
No, I don't think I am that bad off, he said.
Then he asked for a glass of milk, a request that was gently refused by his doctor. Over the next few hours, between periodic examinations by Dr. Bloom, several of Hennessy's friends and colleagues attempted to elicit a statement from him. But the chief, who was now resting more comfortably under a heavy dose of opiates, continued to insist that he would recover. Toward dawn, however, Hennessy's condition worsened noticeably. Messengers were again sent to fetch his mother. Before she arrived, Captain Beanham tried a last time to coax a statement from the dying man.
Captain, I tell you I am going to get well,
the chief insisted, and when Beenham persisted, Hennessy bluntly dismissed his concerns.
"Your alarm is unnecessary," he said. "These people can't kill me."
This bit of bravado, however, proved empty. After spending a few more minutes with his mother, going over his financial affairs, the chief began to sink rapidly. He held on for a few more hours as friends gathered around his sickbed to pay their last respects. By now, he was incapable of making a declaration even if he wanted to. He died at 9:10 on Thursday morning. By midday, virtually everyone in the city had heard about the dastardly deed perpetrated on Gerrard Street the night before. Evidence that the murder had in fact been the work of Italians was hardly conclusive, but the shocked citizens of New Orleans were fully prepared to think the worst of a group they had long regarded as threatening and undesirable. And so, outrage against the city's Sicilian population was growing by the hour. A quickly composed editorial in the Daily States echoed the opinion of many New Orleanians in condemning a class of foreigners who infest this city, known as Dagos, a term that no one seemed shy about using, even in print. "Heretofore, these people have confined themselves to murdering each other," the paper observed, "and hence, except that these terrible deeds reflect upon the good name of New Orleans, there has not been much for us to complain of." But now that the city had finally begun taking them to task for their outrages, they had struck back in a manner that was utterly intolerable. "They have had the audacity to murder the chief of police," the States wrote, "because he had ferreted out some of their crimes and had become a lion in their path." Several notices, signed by prominent members of the community, appeared in the late editions of the morning newspapers, urging citizens to attend mass meetings and form committees to assist the officers of the law in driving the murderous mafia from our midst. 42 Italians had already been arrested, many on the flimsiest of evidence, and more were being rounded up every hour. Police were ransacking homes in the Italian quarter and elsewhere. Anyone remotely associated with the Matranga family was considered a suspect, no matter what the person's alibi. Many residents kept to their houses all day, knowing that they might be stopped on the street and arrested on the mere suspicion of being Italian. At the central police station, a shrouded portrait of Chief Hennessy now stood in a window overlooking Common Street. Telegrams expressing sympathy and outrage were pouring into the station from all over the country. The city's commercial exchanges were closed, as were many government offices and private businesses. Makeshift memorials to the chief were being put up everywhere, at the Grand Opera House, in the department store windows on Canal Street, and at police stations and firehouses all over the city. At 4:00 that afternoon, a contingent of uniformed police assembled at Francis Johnson & Son's Undertakers to carry Hennessy's coffin to his house on Gerrard Street. Crowds were already surrounding the little shotgun cottage as the officers carried the silk-lined mahogany casket into the front parlor, which was filled with floral arrangements that had been arriving all day. While the grief-stricken Mrs. Hennessy looked on, the casket was opened and its lid replaced with a pane of glass to allow visitors to see the chief's face, which had been heavily made up to conceal his wounds. Over the next hours, hundreds of people came through the house to view the body. More were still waiting outside at 10:00 when, seeing Mrs. Hennessy's exhaustion, a group of Boylan men closed up the house and asked the bystanders to leave. Only the mother and a small number of intimate friends remained inside, keeping vigil overnight until 6 a.m., when the doors would be opened again to allow the flow of mourners to resume. Friday dawned sunny and bright, with only a few high clouds lingering as reminders of the midweek rain. A detail of police arrived at the Gerrard Street cottage at 10 a.m. to carry the chief's coffin on to City Hall. A hearse had been provided by the funeral home, but the pallbearers insisted on carrying the chief the entire way to Lafayette Square, through streets lined with grieving spectators. At the broad marble stairway leading into City Hall, the procession was met by a company of city officials. They took the coffin and carried it into the bright, flower-strewn main council chamber. Here, the pallbearers lifted it onto a bier draped with a large black bearskin in the center of the hall, a few feet from where the remains of another honored son of New Orleans, Jefferson Davis, had lain just a year earlier. The chief's hat, truncheon, and belt were placed on the lid of the coffin. An honor guard of police was stationed at its foot. Only then did police allow the crowds of waiting New Orleanians to enter and pay their last respects, 25 at a time. The solemnities went on all day. At 3, after the singing of a De Profundis in the council chamber, the coffin was carried out to the street again. There it was placed in a hearse, which then joined a mile-long procession to the cemetery, led by the chief's riderless jet-black horse. After a stop at St. Joseph's Church, where Reverend Patrick O'Neill led a funeral service to overflowing pews, the procession continued up Canal Street. Twilight had just set in when the hearse crossed the bridge and passed under the stone arches of the Metairie Cemetery. Here, Hennessy's casket was set down inside a white-painted brick vault, luxuriously entwined with honeysuckle vines. Father O'Neill said a few last words of benediction. As a tribute to their slain chief, scores of New Orleans policemen came forward to throw their badges into the vault. And then a single man stepped up to close the tomb with a makeshift wooden tablet, a temporary marker that would eventually be replaced by a carved marble slab. The man was Thomas C. Anderson, described by the Daily Picayune as David Hennessy's bosom friend. A short but powerfully built figure with penetrating blue eyes and a lush reddish-blonde mustache. No one present could possibly realize it at that moment, but this young man, honoring the first victim of New Orleans' war against its underworlds, would someday find himself at the very center of that war. Over the next 30 years, in fact, Tom Anderson would come to be regarded as the principal symbol of lawlessness in New Orleans, the enemy of the city's better half, the nemesis to all of their aims, and the main target of their efforts to reform and control the city. Nor could Anderson himself have known that his next act would in a sense mark the beginning of that era of turmoil in New Orleans, a time that would see his own star as leader of the city's underworlds rise and fall precipitously. For now, he was just memorializing his old friend, Dave Hennessy, a symbol of law and order cut down too soon in the line of duty. Anderson stepped up to the wooden tablet, took a pencil from his vest pocket, and wrote out the chief's simple epitaph. David Hennessy died October 16, 1890, the date that would mark the beginning of New Orleans' Civil War. Friday, the day of Chief Hennessy's funeral, had been the time for mourning the dead. Saturday was the time to act, and city officials were ready for battle. The man chosen by respectable New Orleans to lead their crusade had been killed before he'd even had a chance to strike the first blow. Now others would have to take command. At 12:35 on Saturday afternoon, a still irate Mayor Shakespeare strode into a special council session at City Hall. The room was filled to capacity with the city's aldermen, members of the police board, and other city officials. Reading from a prepared text, the mayor formally announced the death of David C. Hennessy by the hands of despicable assassins. 4 of the 5 supposed gunmen were already in custody, and police were reportedly closing in on the fifth. But these 5 men represented just a small fraction of the enemy they were facing. "It is clear to me," the mayor stated, "that the wretches who committed this foul deed are the mere hirelings and instruments of others, higher and more powerful than they. These instigators are the men we must find, at any cost." Then, pointing out that he himself had received death threats in the days since Hennessy's shooting, he called upon the assembled aldermen to take action. "The people look to you to take the initiative in this matter," he said. "Act promptly, without fear or favor." The council responded with a standing ovation, as well as a plan. The time had come, Alderman Britton said, for the city to call upon her best citizens to rise to her aid. He proposed the formation of a committee of 50, its members to be selected by the mayor. The committee would investigate the matter of secret Italian murder societies and devise the most effectual and speedy measures for the uprooting and total annihilation of such hell-born associations. The resolution passed unanimously, and Mayor Shakespeare promptly announced the 83 names he had selected in advance for the so-called Committee of 50. They amounted to a collection of New Orleans' wealthiest, most prominent, and most powerful men, a clear sign that what was to come would be, at root, a class war on behalf of the city's native-born elite. The real crime to be avenged here was not just a brutal assassination, but the assassination of a representative of that elite, by a class of citizen considered beneath their notice. "A shining mark have they selected on which to write their contempt for the civilization of the New World," the mayor said in conclusion. We owe it to ourselves and to everything that we hold sacred in this life to see that this blow is the last. We must teach these people a lesson that they will not forget for all time.
Chapter 4. Retribution. It was hard to imagine what was causing the delay. In the main courtroom at St. Patrick's Hall, all eyes were on the door to the upstairs deliberation room, where the jury in the Hennessy murder trial had been sequestered for over 18 hours. Most of the spectators who'd crammed into the courtroom's gallery at 10 a.m. had expected an immediate verdict. According to that morning's Picayune, the jury had supposedly reached its decision very quickly last night, before retiring to bed. But even now, 2 hours after the scheduled start of the morning session, the door to the jury room remained stubbornly closed. For many in New Orleans, it had already been far too long a wait for justice. The lesson that Mayor Shakespeare had promised to teach the enemies of law and order had ultimately taken almost 5 months to unfold. 5 months of late-night raids, wild accusations of citizens against citizens, and blanket arrests of Italians of all stripes. The morning after the Hennessy outrage, there had been talk of immediate violent action to punish the alleged assassins already in custody. But ultimately, the law, such as it was in New Orleans, was allowed to run its course. The Committee of 50, led by YMDA leader W.S. Parkerson, who served as liaison between the committee and the mayor's office, had conducted a vigorous investigation of the alleged conspiracy. Under the committee's often heavy-handed guidance, the police had ultimately arrested more than 100 Italians. Most had subsequently been released for lack of evidence, but the grand jury did end up indicting 19 defendants. 9 had been charged with direct involvement in the shooting. The rest, including prominent Italians like Joseph P. Maceca and Charles Matranga, were held as accessories before the fact. Did these 19 men constitute the entire extent of the conspiracy against Chief Hennessy and the city of New Orleans itself? Few believed that to be so, but bringing this group to justice would at least be a start. Once the trial began, on the morning of February 16, 1891, however, it became immediately obvious just how difficult it would be to secure even this small measure of justice. For one thing, this trial would be only the first of 2 court proceedings for the Hennessy murder. District Attorney Charles Luzenberg, worried about the unwieldiness of a prosecution against 19 defendants at once, had asked for and been granted a severance. Thus, only 9 of the defendants would be tried now, leaving the other 10 for a future action. And even this first trial soon proved to be maddeningly complicated and drawn out. More than 1,300 potential jurors had to be examined simply to find 12 who did not have a fixed opinion about the case, either from local gossip, newspaper reports, or else their own prejudice against Italians. Once a jury was finally impaneled, it had to hear evidence from more than 140 witnesses, over 60 for the prosecution and over 80 for the defense, much of which was contradictory and of dubious reliability. 2 key police witnesses, including Captain William O'Connor himself, who had said goodnight to the chief just moments before the first shot, were for unknown reasons not even called to testify. And arguably the most important witness for the state, a painter named M.L. Peeler, was, according to some convincing defense testimony, quite likely drunk when he supposedly recognized the shooters. Not that the defense witnesses had been any stronger. Many were called merely as character witnesses, attesting to the good name of one or the other defendant. Others provided alibis that were difficult, if not impossible, to corroborate. One defense witness seemed particularly befuddled. He claimed that he saw one of the accused men at the Poydras Market, blocks away from the crime scene, at the exact time of the ambush. When asked how he could be so certain of the hour, he insisted that he had made sure to check the market clock, knowing that he would be asked about it in court, this at a time when he wouldn't even have known that a crime had occurred. And there had been plenty of other distractions to muddy the process of justice. One morning, prizefighter John L. Sullivan showed up to watch the proceedings, which were being closely followed in newspapers worldwide. He was given a seat of honor right next to the jury box, so that the great Irish boxer could ensure that the great Irish policeman would be properly avenged. Meanwhile, rumors began circulating that some of the jurors had been bribed by agents for the defense. Private Detective Dominic O'Malley, a known associate of defendant Charles Matranga,
was soon arrested and accused of offering money to jurors in exchange for a not guilty verdict. And as if all of this weren't enough, one of the defendants, a non-English-speaking fruit peddler named Emmanuel Polizzi, had continually disrupted the proceedings with fits of real or feigned madness, stomping his feet, throwing himself on the floor, and even trying to bite anyone who came near him.